You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Andre whā oso tōku ingoa. Nau mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpa Wednesday, everybody. I hope you're all staying dry out there. I'm your host, Andre, and I'll be with you for the next hour. Joining me in the studio a little bit later on is producer Alex Bonham. FIR Kene, coming up on the show, I speak to Lauren Vanell, Lecturer of Emergency Management at Massey University, about yesterday's extreme weather, how Aucklanders and emergency management teams reacted to it, and how in the future, as these events become more frequent, how we may need to change our approach. Basically asking, are you just better off to stay where you are, and if you aren't in immediate danger, should you stay indoors, not on the roads? I also speak to Dylan Nasafo, Senior Lecturer in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland, about why the 2021 Dawn Raids apology wasn't enough for the Pacific community, and also about recent revelations that Dawn Raids are still happening in the Pacific community. On the Green Desk, Jack Marshall speaks to Sarah Beerling, a Restore Passenger Rail supporter from Wellington, about why causing traffic chaos and delays in the Wellington CBD is good for their cause. Alex speaks to Grant Hewison from Lawyers for Climate Action and Associate Professor Alice Longley about the physical and online exhibition Let Us Drink the New Wine Together. E aha o whakaaro, I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 09309 3879. Kawa e ware I ahei. Ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō he pākihere roki roki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Poho. Me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Classic journal question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
The extreme weather system that is continuing to affect the North Island caused havoc throughout Tāmaki Makaurau on Tuesday. The state of emergency declared in Auckland drew stark contrast to the Auckland anniversary floods in January and Cyclone Gabrielle in February. Auckland Emergency Management, Civil Defence and Auckland Council sprung into action as the rains poured down throughout the city, with heavy rain warnings issued in North and West Auckland. As extreme weather events appear to become more frequent, do Aucklanders and management agencies need to reconsider how they react and deal with these situations? To receive input and analysis, whilst also determining how well agencies have responded to the recent weather, I spoke with Dr. Lauren Vanell, Lecturer of Emergency Management at Massey University. Auckland saw quite a large influx of people on the roads, causing hours-long travel delays. Do you think this mass exodus out of the CBD and from different regions in the city could be quite unwarranted and cause travel delays for first responders and essential services that need to access the roads?
I'm not sure about unwarranted. We definitely want people to be somewhere safe during flooding and ideally have families and households together. We do also, though, want to have roads clear enough for essential services. And we have seen some fairly dangerous driving through floodwaters, which is a concern. With something like a severe weather event, which we do have a little bit of warning for, it would be great to see more support for people to stay home or get somewhere safe ahead of time so we don't see these traffic jams.
Do you think, how would you rate the response of Auckland Emergency Management, Civil Defence and the Mayor's Office as they continue to respond in the aftermath of Tuesday's weather?
Yeah, I guess first, I would just like to acknowledge the mahi that emergency management and council are doing. The vast majority are good people doing their best while they're also dealing with these impacts themselves. Now, acknowledging that I'm not an Aucklander, so I didn't live through it, it seems there has definitely been some strong points to this response. It was great to see proactive communication and swift action in particular. And of course, there's always things that can be done better in any emergency response in any part of the country. So for me, the main test of the emergency management and council response will be in how they learn and improve for next time. Probably not something people want to be thinking about right now, but unfortunately they probably will be next time.
Is the response of Aucklanders to these extreme weather events becoming quite coded now? Do you think we're going to get used to it, especially since this is the third time in the past 4 months that we've had an event like this happen in the region?
That's a really interesting question, and it's probably something we're going to have to find the answer to. Fortunately, these sorts of repeated events aren't too common, although with climate change they might become more common. There's a really fine balance between getting used to something so that you know what to do in response and how to do it, and becoming normalised to something where you maybe stop taking it as seriously.
Where do you think trauma and stress play a role in how Aucklanders responded to the anniversary floods through to Gabrielle and then yesterday's weather?
Yeah, so stress is an adaptive response. It's part of our body's way to keep us going and alert in dangerous situations. But it does impact our decision-making and it can heighten emotions, both positive and negative. Particularly for those Aucklanders who have been hit repeatedly, the stress and anxiety from previous events can compound. This might affect people's ability to process information and make the best decisions.
Do you think as these events, like you said, that as climate change causes effects on our weather patterns and these events become more frequent, that we're going to have to review how we do respond to these events in the future? I guess where I'm going with this question is, do you think that council, emergency management and civil defence should roll out an alert system or some type of alert plan similar to, you know, the ones that were used during COVID to smoothly roll out an emergency response in these extreme weather events?
Yeah, so council and emergency management do have response plans, and it's really important that these get reviewed every time that there is an emergency event like this. What I'd really like to see is continuing and maybe increased public education around things like weather and flooding so that people in communities know what to do maybe without having to receive an alert, but also so that they understand what their council and local emergency management are going to be doing in response, when they might get an alert, when they might not, and what they should be doing in response to it. So it's that conjunction of, you know, improving our response plans as much as possible, but also making sure that the public knows enough about what those are, but also know enough about the hazards so that they can act in the best way for themselves.
Do you think Aucklanders and actually just people across the country, as they become subject to all these weather events, will grow somewhat complacent to the warnings that are given to them? And do you think there is a silver lining where we can continue to live our lives amidst this weather, these weather irregularities that are just becoming more and more common? And will we heed information and advice from these agencies still in the same way?
Yeah, those are great questions. So extreme weather is a slightly tricky hazard because we do have forecasts, which are usually right, which is great, but they aren't always. So we know there can be a bit of backlash if warnings are sent and then the impacts don't arrive. So there's that balance of, you know, warning people when they are in danger, but not when, you know, we're really uncertain about the hazard, I guess. And yeah, we don't want people getting complacent about these events. We know that that can happen, particularly if people experience a lot of events and aren't too negatively impacted themselves. We know that people tend to assume future events will be like past events. So if people have been through, you know, floods or whatever and they've been okay, they might get complacent about their risk in future. There is definitely, you know, silver linings to these events. We do in New Zealand learn from events pretty well compared to other places around the world. And I mean, hopefully, I know it might be a bit too soon, but hopefully people in Auckland and up north who've been through these events, they do feel like they are better able to cope with them in future because of what they've learned, you know, what they've learned that helps them and what doesn't help them and what they should do.
That was Lauren Vanell, Lecturer of Emergency Management at Massey University, speaking to me about the response to Auckland's floods this week.
What's his title? The guy in charge, Dr. Ashley Brim?
The Director General of Health.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Over the weekend, government officials and Pacific community leaders met to discuss continued dawn raids on the Pasifika community, despite the official dawn raid apology in 2021. On the 19th of April, a dawn raid on a household led to the arrest of a Tongan man. Amongst those there at the meeting were Deputy Prime Minister Carmel Sepuloni and Immigration Minister Michael Wood. Michael Wood indicated at the meeting that he was considering granting amnesty to all overstayers in Aotearoa. To talk more about what has and hasn't happened for the Pacific community following the Dawn Raid's apology, I spoke to Dylan Nasuffle, Senior Lecturer in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland.
You said in your E Tangata opinion piece that you believed government officials crafted a fake apology to, quote, respond to calls for an apology, all without making any real changes to demonstrate an adequate appreciation of what the Dawn Raids did and are still doing to our Pacific communities. What more do you think needs to be done?
So I think a lot more needs to be done. Granting amnesty for people overstaying their temporary visas is absolutely urgent for our people vulnerable to being dawn raided. But fundamentally, to get to the root causes of injustices for our communities, I think we need to dismantle the colonial system of government that we have at the moment. I think we all need to understand that there will never be any justice or equity in Aotearoa as long as the colonial system of government is in place. So we need to pursue constitutional transformation based on honouring Te Tiriti o Waitangi to dismantle our current systems, including our immigration systems, to build ones that aren't based on exploiting migrants and brutalising them when they no longer feel the labour needs of the nation. So there needs to be a lot more transformation. We have some urgent causes that need to be addressed, such as granting amnesty, but we need fundamental transformation as well.
Why haven't the Dawn Raids stopped? Do you think the government still see it as the only way to carry out its immigration mandates?
I think the state hasn't stopped dawn raiding people because of our immigration system, which is fundamentally racist, like all other systems in our colonial government. Our laws give New Zealand, Immigration New Zealand and the police a lot of discretion and power to enforce deportation orders. And those are the things that are issued once a person's temporary visa expires. And there are no qualifications on this power, no real limits to this power to execute deportation orders. So when you have a system that's fundamentally racist and you have broad discretion given to people within the system, you're going to have these sorts of situations where people are going to be dawn raided. And something also worth mentioning is that our Immigration Act specifically says that complaints under our Human Rights Act, which outlaws discrimination based on race, that those complaints aren't allowed. So the racism, the injustice is baked into our system. It's no coincidence that dawn raids continue because the system is exactly the same as it always has been, and the government has never once taken the step to specifically outlaw dawn raids. So it's bound to happen again.
I'm sure you're aware of the meeting between Pacifica community leaders and government officials over the weekend in Auckland. Do you think that Michael Wood's statement at that meeting about declaring amnesty to, or whether or not he would declare amnesty for all overstayers within Aotearoa, generates unhealthy speculation and also generates unhealthy feelings and uncertainty for people in the Pacific community who are scared of what they may be subject to in light of what's been happening most recently?
I think it's really fair and understandable to have skepticism towards this, rhetoric from Michael Wood that they're taking the granting amnesty quite seriously, especially given the government's track record when it comes to actually taking radical action for our communities. I personally think Michael Wood is one of the better Labour ministers, tends to, I think, have integrity with the way that he carries out his portfolios and has a great reputation in Mount Roskill, his electorate, which has a high migrant population, high Pacific population, who I'm sure he knows he's accountable to. So I do have some faith that he's personally not misleading people, but this is a highly political issue. Even though he's the Minister of Immigration, he is accountable to Cabinet, which has a range of different priorities and agendas, including political ones, given the election. And it is important to note that even though granting amnesty is the most just and equitable way forward, other people don't see it that way. And other people are thinking about the backlash, particularly amongst racist Pākehā, that would come with granting amnesty. So that's something to be wary of when thinking about this, I guess, a hopeful discussion that Michael Wood is leading, is that there's other things at play. But I think that he, I think of all Labour ministers, is best placed to advance this cause, if that makes sense.
What do you think was attained by the government meeting over the weekend? Do you think it was somewhat of another superficial thing, just as you position the 2021 Dawn Raids apology? Because I guess if you look at the outcomes of that meeting, what changes have resulted from it?
Yeah, again, I think I really understand that skepticism. I, of course, share it myself. But the thing with these big proposals to grant amnesty is that they do require consultation and actually meeting with communities in order to actually move forward. So while we need to be wary of it being a performative gesture and it really just getting, you know, people's hopes up, it is actually a necessary step if we're going to get this big radical change through. So I think we just need to keep applying the pressure and making it clear to Minister Wood and the Prime Minister that these performative gestures, these consultations, they're not going to cut it. They need to be followed through with hard action. And more than that, I think there needs to also be consultation with Tangata Whenua, because that is a requirement of Te Tiriti o Waitangi, is making sure that any major decision, especially regarding Pacific peoples who share sacred whakapapa links with Māori, that the way that, you know, of Pacific peoples, but also other tauiwi of colour, other migrants, that the way that they are welcomed into this country is according to the wishes and tikanga of Māori.
What, I guess, the more fundamental question, especially relating back to your statements around the Dawn Raid apology and your position on what it means within the, well, what wider implications it had within society for Pasifika here in Aotearoa, what do you think has changed for the better and for the worst for Pasifika since the apology?
I think that's a really interesting question. There were some gestures that were a part of the apology, like scholarships and funds for important work by artists and historians around the history of the Dawn Raids. So I think those are great and in fact need to be extended. But something that I'm concerned with as being a consequence of the Dawn Raids apology is that there's a perception even amongst many people in Pacific communities that the government has atoned for its injustices, that the Dawn Raids is officially in the past, that we're entering a new era of justice and equity with regards to Pacific peoples, with regard to immigration. And that perception is extremely dangerous, because I think it not only kind of gives us a false sense of security, it also inhibits radical action, such as pursuing not only just amnesty for people who are overstaying, but also radical transformation to our racist colonial immigration system and the government system in general. I think we need to understand that despite the apologies and whatever apology might follow, we need to understand that equity and justice for our peoples will never be possible as long as the colonial government is in place. So we need to dismantle these systems that seem permanent, that seem like our only reality. We need to dismantle them and build better ones. And we need to let Māori lead the way with that, according to Te Tiriti o Waitangi.
That was Dylan Nasafo, Senior Lecturer in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland, speaking to me about the continued effects of the Dawn Raids on the Pasifika community. BFM. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
Brawler.
Hey, you're right. Okay, what about treasure trunks and six?
Chests.
They said you were good. Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
Batiko Beats with Juliana Sion, Dylan Kalev and guests with support from DJ Lucas Dapp.
And tomorrow,
Ed Kerver live, followed by Zola Frink, Carlotta and Friends of All the World.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Music quiz time. Is the whole team here?
Yeah.
Dad rock expert.
Yeah.
Techno master.
Yep.
Hip hop geek.
Yep.
Jazz aficionado. Where's the jazz aficionado? I said meet at 7.
I think their watch is set to a weird time signature.
Yeah, 7-8.
Get your team ready for the Tuning Forks Monday Music Quiz, fortnightly on Mondays. Hosted by Brendan Green, free entry and great prizes to be won. The Tuning Forks Monday Music Quiz, this Monday at the Tuning Fork. Sign up at thetuningfork.co.nz.
Science! Science is all around us. This rock...
Hello. Yeah, I'm voicing it now. Still on Tuesday? Change of host? Not toast, host. I don't mention... Right. But where do we go to find out about more science?
Dear Science, join the Tuesday Wire team as they speak to a rotating roster of boffins and brainiacs chatting about discoveries, controversies and general scientific wonder. Dear Science, every Tuesday Wire on 95BFM. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media and got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
You're back on The Wire on 95BFM. Lawyers for Climate Action are challenging the government for ignoring the advice of the Climate Commission around the pricing of carbon. Alex Bonham asked Grant Hewison, University of Auckland law lecturer, and one of the lawyers involved with the group, about why they are taking the government to court.
Lawyers for Climate Action New Zealand, or LACANZI, are taking what's called a judicial review. So this is a kind of legal process where you are challenging whether a decision made by, in this case, the government, but a public body, has been made properly. And the way our legal system works is that if you're a government body, you get the rights to exercise power, make decisions from Parliament, and then Parliament sets out the framework for how you make those decisions. And then if someone believes that you haven't made your decision in accordance with those powers, then they can take what's called a judicial review proceeding. So this is a cabinet decision late last year, where they rejected the advice of the Climate Change Commission that was to allow the price of carbon to rise. So the Climate Change Commission, within the legislation that governs these things, the Zero Carbon Act, has a role in basically providing advice to the government, in this case around the price of carbon. And their advice was to meet our international obligations in terms of an emissions reduction plan for New Zealand, was that we should allow the price of carbon to rise. And the reason for that is it creates behaviour change. So if the cost of carbon increases, then we'll be looking both from a business point of view and from a societal point of view to things other than carbon-based fossil fuels to, for example, create energy. So an example might be that you currently have a gas-fired water heater at your house, and if the price of carbon rises, then at some point the cost of running your gas heater will rise as well. And you then might look instead, the next time you make a choice for investment in a heating system, is go, oh, I'll go electric because the price of that hasn't risen. So the whole idea of carbon pricing is that it influences the behaviour of the whole of, you know, everyone living in New Zealand, but particularly in this case, business as well.
I'm interested in the emissions trading scheme because it goes two ways, doesn't it? On the one hand, your gas is more expensive, so you get rid of your gas heater, but it's also an opportunity for the government to collect revenue so they could perhaps discount the electric heat pump or solar panels or invest in R&D or public transport or in managed retreat or other things that can help us with the just transition. So not getting this money has also meant there is less money in government to support shifting as well.
Yeah.
Is that right? So you're suing James Shaw as Minister for Climate Change, but he recommended following the advice and was overruled. Why can't you sue the Prime Minister or the Cabinet?
Yeah. So the way the legislation works, you know, coming back to this is a judicial review process, so you have to go back to who holds the power in terms of these decisions, and it's the climate change minister. So our only avenue is to essentially take him to the High Court in terms of a judicial review of this decision, because he ultimately is the minister responsible for that decision. So there's a bit of a circular process. James Shaw, together with the Climate Commission, recommended that the price of carbon rise. Our understanding is that the Cabinet considered that and basically said, look, we don't want to add to the kind of price rises that are going on at the moment, the cost of living costs that are going up. So we're going to make a decision not to follow the advice of the Climate Change Commission or the Minister. And we're going to make the decision not to allow the price of carbon to rise. But that decision basically remains the responsibility of the minister. So we've got to take him as a minister responsible to the High Court and judicial review that decision, despite even him recommending initially that the price of carbon should rise.
What do you want to achieve with this case?
Look, we're in a climate crisis. And if you've been living in Auckland for the last few months, you'll know what that crisis means. We're just getting torrential rainfall now on a much more regular basis than we've ever had before. Even today, Alex, you know, we were out there in the weather today and it was looking pretty grim here in Auckland as well. And everyone feels nervous. You know, it's interesting that we've now got, Aucklanders kind of going, oh, it's raining. Does that mean we're now going to experience flooding? So we're starting to feel the psychological effects of climate change here and now in Auckland. The reason that we as a body of lawyers do this work is we have a privilege as lawyers. We've been trained, and there's some exceptional lawyers who are part of Lawyers for Climate Action New Zealand. And we don't want to leave this to the next generation. It's our generation that has to be challenging these decisions. So where we see decisions made by government that don't follow the law, then we feel it is necessary to stand up and use that privilege and take the opportunity to challenge those decisions in this judicial review process before the High Court. And that's what we've done in this case. We've done it in other cases, and there are ongoing cases where we're taking those challenges as well. And it's because, ultimately, we are in a climate crisis, and unless we make some hard decisions and start moving in the right direction, we're not going to leave our children and our grandchildren with a planet that they can live on.
In the best case scenario, the government would do a U-turn and follow the Climate Change Commission advice. Is that something that they can actually do?
I need to get down into the mechanics of how this works. It may be possible. Basically, once you've made a decision under a piece of legislation, sometimes it's fixed and you can't go back. And I'm not sure if that's the case with this or not. Sometimes you can go back and revisit your decision. But it may be the case that the government can't, in which case the High Court is really the only body that can look at this decision make a decision about whether it followed the law properly in terms of making this decision. And Cabinet made a decision, which ultimately became a decision of the Minister for Climate Change, to base that decision on a cost of living concern. And that's not the proper basis for making that decision. You can't, in our view, use the cost of living as a reason for essentially making a decision under the Zero Carbon Act.
Do you think you'll win this?
The reason for taking these challenges is always that we think that we have a case that is a good case to take, and is a case that is based on well thought through reasons, has a good legal framework around it, and there are real issues to be put in front of a court.
That was Grant Hewison from Lawyers for Climate Action, talking about why the government must meet its emissions reduction obligations.
Trees, mountains, a curious kittadoo.
It's time for the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
Why would anyone want to piss off tens of thousands of people in order to restore rail in New Zealand? Well, that's exactly what protesters are doing in Wellington, blocking main roads at peak hour traffic. Now, that's not making any friends on the road. And as it turns out, that's basically the point. They don't want to change hearts. They just want your eyes and ears. This week on the Green Desk, I spoke with Sarah Belling, who is a Restore Passenger Rail supporter and took part in a protest. I wanted to hear from Sarah why they're pissing off a whole bunch of people and how that's going to get rail back chugging along in New Zealand. Here's Sarah.
So I was part of the Terrace Tunnel protest a few weeks ago. I think it was Monday the 17th of April. So I was part of a group of four women sitting on the road blocking the entrance of Terrace Tunnel. Now, I was sitting on the shoulder, so that's where we would have let ambulances through, and because of that, I didn't glue myself to the road, but a couple of the people did.
Oh, wow. And so what time was this exactly as well in the morning? And like, could you kind of run us through about what happened? Because I imagine that would be quite an intense experience.
So this was about 8 a.m. on a Monday morning, rush hour traffic. Yeah, we did have a few angry motorists come up to us on the road and, ask what the hell we were doing there. And that's why we had our de-escalation team to talk to those people to calm them down. And the people on the road were just able to sit there calmly until the police arrived.
So what did you say to the protesters? Angry people out of their cars?
So I didn't get a chance to speak to them personally, but we would have just explained why we were there, that the police were on their way to deal with the situation, and that, to give them a timeline of how long the disruption would be. And for a lot of these angry motorists, they just want someone to vent their anger to. So with the two people that came up to us, they, had their angry moment, and then they realised, I'm on the clock, I'm being paid for this, it's not that bad. And calmed down by the time the media tried interviewing them.
So why is it so important for you guys, you in particular and the organisation, that passenger rail be restored?
Yeah, so we've gone with restoring passenger rail because it's quite a popular demand, as seen by the amount of submissions from the parliamentary inquiry into interregional passenger rail last year. And because it's quite low-hanging fruit in terms of reducing emissions, since the train tracks are already there, they're just being used for freight and tourist services at the moment. So the first step of restoring passenger rail services would just be to add some rolling stock onto those existing lines to carry passengers at an affordable price.
I've always been quite fascinated by basically pissing a load of people off as like a form of protest would be the kind of route you wanted to go down to try get this across the line. And I guess what you're saying is that you actually don't need to win people over because, by and large, people actually quite like rail. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. What we're doing is making the popular demand of restoring passenger rail and free public transport impossible to ignore.
Mm. So do you think it's working so far?
Yes. Yes. So just as a personal example, so I was part of the March 3rd climate strike this year, and we had thousands of people come out to show their frustration at the government inaction on climate change. And like, we got a day of media attention and then it kind of died out. And then we had Chris Hipkins announcing the withdrawal of a bunch of climate policies. We had our mayor here in Auckland announce budget cuts to climate action. And it's like they've completely ignored those thousands of people who are marching for the climate. But with the Restore Passenger Rail protests, we've had more media coverage in a three-week period than any other campaign has had in a three-week period. And we've got media and politicians constantly talking about this, even on the days when we're not doing these protests.
Mm, so coming at it from a kind of, I don't know, political action, I don't know, lens, it's like you're really just trying to set the agenda rather than convince the public of this. Mm. But I mean, it does set the agenda, but is it, do you think it's going to actually change people's mind, like the decision makers' minds on this? Because at the moment, they seem to be, doesn't seem to be, I don't know, making inroads at the moment, or is it?
So we've seen this tactic of blocking roads work overseas. So we're part of the A22 network, which is a network of 11 campaigns from high per capita emitting countries across the world. And you may have heard of Just Stop Oil in the UK.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they were previously Insulate Britain, and they were using the same tactics we are of blocking roads and demanding insulation. And this was a hugely popular demand. So their actions of blocking roads were effective enough and brought insulation to the top of the political agenda. And now with the Just Stop Oil campaign, all of the UK parties except the Tories have agreed to the demand of stopping new oil and gas licensing. So yeah, this gives me a lot of hope for climate action in New Zealand, because it's been exhausting trying to make a difference through petitions, submissions, protest marches, and not seeing anything happen, really. Yeah, now that we're taking this action and we're seeing it having effects in other countries, I've got a lot of hope that we'll push through with this.
Mm. And so can you give us any insight on it? I don't know, what's next with the movement, or is it just kind of staying in the media, and any hints?
Yeah, so basically we'll just keep the pressure on until the government shows a commitment to restoring passenger rail and free public transport. Yeah, if any of your listeners are interested in getting involved with us, we have a website, restorepassengerrail.nz, where you can sign up for intro talks to come take arrestable or non-arrestable action with us. And there's also links to donate on their website.
So in June this year, there's going to be the inquiry into the future of interregional passenger rail coming out. If the government or, you know, the national or whatever kind of looks favourably at taking those kind of recommendations on, would that mean you guys kind of go away?
Yeah, that's one of our demands ticked off. We also have the additional demand this year of free public transport. So we would keep pushing for that one to be implemented as well. But that would be like an amazing win for the campaign and for, yeah, all of New Zealand to have those passenger rail services restored.
And that was Sarah Beerling from the Restore Passenger Rail group. Thanks so much for coming on the show, and I hope you all enjoyed that Green Desk, a little bit of something different this week. See you later.
That was the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
You're on BFM, you're listening to The Wire. We'll be right back after a short break, if it is planned.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
The exhibition Let Us Drink the New Wine Together is currently on till 13th of May in Howick, but it's also online. People listening can Google Let Us Drink the New Wine Together and click on the link to the online portal. Be transported into a sociable and intriguing online world. I started off by asking how to pronounce the name of Alice's Chilean collaborator.
Máximo Corvalán Pincheira.
Máximo Corvalán Pincheira.
Yeah, Pincheira. Yeah.
Pincheira.
Yeah, there you go.
Cool. Yeah. So the exhibition that you did together is currently on at the Uxbridge Gallery in Howick, Let Us Drink the New Wine Together. But it's also online. You can Google Let Us Drink the New Wine Together, find the Uxbridge Gallery, and there's a link to the online portal there too. And I'm in it right now, and you let them take control of your camera, and I can see my little face in a circle, and I'm getting posted around the world to enjoy the work and perhaps meet some other people along the way. And it's very playful and a way of connecting to the world from one's room. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about the work and how it came about.
So the virtual exhibition was made because this was a pandemic project. Máximo Corvalán Pincheira and I were both supposed to be having residencies in Sweden when the pandemic happened. And so we decided to have an exhibition between New Zealand and Chile instead. And so we created a body of work, and then everything was so precarious that we were like, well, this might not ever make it into a museum or an art gallery or any kind of space where we can have audiences and rooms. And so I collaborated with Kate Stevenson, who was a student at the University of Auckland, actually, and Chris White, who also, I met them when they were doing their masters in film, and then they became game designers. So they got really into film production, but also gaming, but also how then you can bring museums into being both material spaces and galleries and museums, but also virtual spaces. So they're really interested in that fold between the virtual world and the material. And they're animators, and their team, Dot Dot, are based in New York. They have this incredible team of software designers, animation experts, VR people. And so Kate and Chris offered us their platform, which is Dot Dot Social, to work as an art space. So we could create this labyrinth of interconnected rooms. And the cool thing about this platform, it's bespoke, so it's created by the people who are running it, you know, it's not like using Google as your platform, like they've started it from scratch, is that it mimics the sociality of the art gallery, so that if you and I happen to, I'm in the cardboard room, by the way, if you happen to make it to the cardboard room, Alex, I'll be able to see you and we'll be able to chat inside. Our two will be able to see each other and hear each other, and if you're close to me, we can talk, but if you go to the other side of the screen, then we won't be able to hear each other. So there's this idea that people can gather in little pods inside the room, the virtual room, and chat, hang out, see each other, be present together inside the artwork. So if you imagine there's a series of artworks that are interconnected by these little portals, the exhibition has an element of gaming, of online gaming, and an element of a Zoom call. It kind of brings all that together to create this sociality of the art world. And obviously that came out of the pandemic situation where we were finding ways to connect with each other from our isolation, from the isolation of our homes, and to be able to continue create with our creative practices and continuing to share creative ideas and artistic ideas. And so, yeah, that's how that all came to be.
There are loads of envelopes in the exhibition too. How are they connected to your COVID experience?
Yeah, envelopes are one of the really important parts of this whole show. So we have the online exhibition there, but the online exhibition is open right now because of the exhibition at the Malcolm Smith Gallery, which is up for the rest of the week. So when Máximo and I started to collaborate, we were really interested in creating a work that was about artists continuing to practice in this time of border control. And Maximo has kind of a history of working with, he likes to push up against borders. That's kind of his artistic practice. He'll find a border space or a political issue and he'll figure out how he can sort of press into it or press the bruise of it in these points of tension. So the way that we kind of pressed the bruise of border control during the pandemic was through creating envelopes that we sent across literal borders in the literal post across the world. So we had a series of envelope artworks, postal artworks, that we posted. We started sending them in about May 2020, and they've kept travelling. Some of them are kind of still travelling now. So it's been more than, how many years is that? We're coming up to 3 years that these envelopes have been kind of connecting artists through touch, but via the bodies of envelopes. So I worked with my partner, Jeffrey Holdaway, who's a watercolour artist, to create envelopes that are kind of artworks of themselves. So each artwork has a painting on one side, and I made some little artworks. And then, so if I made one envelope, I would send it, we'd aim to have it by the hands of five artists, the same envelope. So it would go like Auckland to Fiji, Fiji to Italy, Italy to Thailand, Thailand to Santiago, Chile. We managed to do it. So we had about 11 envelopes that made it back to Chile from New Zealand, and we managed to have envelopes cross through all the continents of the world. So we had one that got to the Congo during the pandemic. We had Fiji, we had Japan, we had Thailand, we had lots of different parts of Europe, as far north as Sweden and Montreal and Iceland. Envelopes show up in Mongolia, but then it got lost, and we lost envelopes in Uganda and the south of Patagonia. So we really, Maximo and I, both as artists who have international practices, we have networks of friends who we've met at various different events, and yeah, we just asked our friends if they'd join us for this project, and it was really wonderful, the kind of heart of it, to connect to our friends and have our friends have the envelope arrive to their houses in the time of the pandemic, and then, you know, they could keep something from the envelope, but they swapped something into it. So it's just like a giant chain letter, you know, in practice, but really pressing into friendship and pressing into thinking around how we can very gently try to continue to make work to resist border control with, in a safe and healthy way that supported the kind of mandates that governments were giving about closing borders. Yeah, and it was just amazing having that documentation sent to us from our friends in different parts of the world as the envelopes crossed the world right through that whole time of the pandemic. And that's kind of the heart of the exhibition. The other heart of the exhibition is digital maps. So Max found a base kind of world map, and we sent it to about 26 artists in different parts of the world to rewrite the map, so make an artistic intervention into the map and return it to us, and they became artworks as well. So those envelopes and maps are the centre of that virtual exhibition. We then animated the maps and turned them into little film animations and video animations, so the visitors to our digital site kind of portal their way through these rooms that are made out of digital maps and envelope pieces.
Oh.
Can I just say one thing just to add in?
Yes, please.
So people who are interested, they can go and see the show at the Malcolm Smith Gallery in Auckland. And they can, right now, you know, it's open 24/7 until Sunday. The virtual exhibition is open. But they might also want to check out Maximo Corvalan Pincheta's website. We can put a link of that up on the BFM website, and so people can see the work that he's doing, because there's just so much interesting artwork happening in Chile, and it's so great to be able to connect the art world of Chile with the art world of Aotearoa. And he's making these quite magnificent large-scale works in Chile right now, and we have our exhibition up, so it feels like there's this connection between the work happening in Chile and the work happening in Auckland. It's really nice for viewers to be able to check out those websites and see that work.
That was Associate Professor Alice Longley from the University of Auckland talking about the physical and online exhibition Let Us Drink the New Wine Together. The link to the exhibition and Maximo's work will be put on the BFM website along with the interview podcast.
That was The Wire.
Koe rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Lauren Vanell, Lecturer of Emergency Management at Massey University. Dylan Asafo, Senior Lecturer in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland. Sarah Beerling from Restore Passenger Rail. Grant Hewison, University of Auckland Law Lecturer and member of Lawyers for Climate Action, and Associate Professor Alice Longley. And thanks to Alex for joining me in the studio today. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The Wonderful with Bridge. See you next week. Stay dry, everybody.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.